listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Club Rules. When the Commander-in-Chief departs the White House, he's typically welcomed into a close-knit brotherhood of former presidents. In an exclusive excerpt from her new book, Team of Five, Kate Anderson Brower reveals why Donald Trump will be left out of the world's most elite fraternity, with illustrations by Mike Toffanelli. Opening illustration shows a meeting, a social gathering in the White House with former presidents Clinton and Lincoln enjoying a drink, talking together, Jimmy Carter, both Bushes, Washington, Obama, and Nixon, all enjoying hors d'oeuvres, wine, martinis, various libations, talking, laughing, having a pretty great time. And there stands Trump, all by himself, arms crossed, scowling, looking extremely unhappy. This article is adapted from Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump, by Kate Anderson Brower. Copyright 2020 by Kate Anderson Brower. To be published on May 19, 2020, by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Excerpted by permission. It is a brilliantly sunny day in the spring of 2019 when I sit down across from President Donald Trump in the Oval Office, ready to discuss how he imagines a particular aspect of his post-presidential life, that of his relationship with his fellow former presidents. Because one overlooked casualty of Trump's norm-defying presidential tenure is the way he has upended the unspoken rules among living former presidents, who have traditionally welcomed one another enthusiastically, regardless of party, into the world's most exclusive club. In the club, which has its own set of expectations and its own unique set of personalities, power is never completely relinquished. The four living former presidents will always be called Mr. President, and that is how they want it. During the Trump era, from January 2017 to November 2018, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama were all members of the so-called President's Club until the elder Bush's death. Despite their different political trajectories, all have lived their post-presidential years fully understanding what is expected of them. Some are more engaged than others, but there is a precedent they all adhere to, with the exception of Carter, who has paid for his disobedience with occasional suspensions from the club. At times throughout history, other former presidents have shirked these rules, but doing so has come at a steep price. Their all-important legacies are forever tarnished. By the time I meet Trump in the Oval Office, I have already spent 2 years interviewing top aides, close friends, and family members of the former presidents, and traveled to Plains, Georgia, to sit down with the Carters. We are nearly a year away from the early, uncertain days of the novel coronavirus pandemic, when Trump will tell a CNBC reporter, "We have it totally under control. It's going to be just fine." Former presidents used to help each other in times of crisis. Trump has made that impossible. He has not spoken with Obama or Clinton since his inauguration more than 3 years ago. Aside from a brief hello and goodbye to Obama during George H.W. Bush's funeral in December 2018. In fact, the only substantive conversation he and Obama have had was during the customary visit Trump made to the Oval Office 2 days after he won the 2016 election. He has been criticizing him ever since. "I didn't like the job that he and Biden did," Trump said at a Fox News town hall in March. "I didn't like the position they put us in." Seeking to justify his administration's bungled response to the novel coronavirus outbreak in America, he attacked Obama, tweeting that his handling of the 2009 H1N1 swine flu was a full-scale disaster, with thousands dying and nothing meaningful done to fix the testing problem. Contrast that with John F. Kennedy, who called on all three of his living predecessors to ask for their help during the Cuban Missile Crisis. A year and a half earlier, after the Bay of Pigs disaster, Kennedy had reached out to the man he'd just defeated, Richard Nixon, and to his Republican predecessor, Dwight D. Eisenhower. He knew he could not afford to be too proud to ask for help. "No one knows how rough this job is until after he has been in it a few months," Kennedy confessed to Eisenhower. Ronald Reagan sent Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Carter to Anwar Sadat's 1981 Cairo funeral during a sensitive global moment that could have precipitated more violence. And then there's the way the former presidents supported George W. Bush after 9/11, and how George H.W. Bush and Clinton traveled the world together, seeking help after the tsunami in Asia, and in their leadership roles raising money after Hurricane Katrina. They became near-constant companions, doing interviews together, and even traveling with George W. as part of the American delegation to Pope John Paul II's 2005 funeral in Rome. "Come on," Bush Sr. implored Clinton. "It will be better with you along." Nicknamed the A-Team in the press, they became like father and son. Time made them Partners of the Year in its 2005 Person of the Year issue. After seeing how powerful the Clinton-Bush team was, President Obama dispatched George W. Bush and Clinton to Haiti to raise awareness and funds after the devastating 2010 earthquake. This kind of teamwork and camaraderie now seems unthinkable and almost quaint. Former presidents typically don't initiate calls to the sitting president to offer their help because it could come across as meddling. But two people close to George W. Bush say that Bush is open to a call from Trump, even though there is no love lost between the two men. They haven't spoken at any length since two phone calls during the confirmation of controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, who had worked in the Bush White House. One former top Trump official who knows both men well said that if Trump were to call on Bush for help during this pandemic, Bush would swallow hard and he would help however he can for the good of the nation. That's the kind of person he is. But Trump's doing that is nearly inconceivable. His ego and his dismissal of the former presidents are all part of his mindset, this person said, on the condition of anonymity. "Early on, I was shocked by some of the things he said about the former presidents. It's not pretty. In my lifetime, I haven't seen a president so self-centered," adding, "It is ironic that Trump doesn't hesitate to call up strongmen autocrats like Putin and Erdogan, who are not our friends. But he wouldn't call up Obama, Clinton, or even Bush during this crisis." Given all of this, it is hard to imagine that whenever he does leave the White House, Trump will receive a warm welcome into the club. He has accused his immediate predecessor of wiretapping his office ahead of the 2016 election and called his most recent Republican predecessor's foreign policy the worst in history. He perpetually notes that his relationships with other world leaders are better than those of former presidents. But have the years he spent in that awe-inspiring office given him empathy for what his predecessors went through? No, he replies flatly. Unlike most of the men who came before him, who aged prematurely and struggled with insomnia while in office, often pacing the halls of the White House in the dead of the night, overwhelmed by the gravity of the position, Trump said he has no trouble sleeping. When I ask him whether he would go to Obama's presidential library opening, the question sounds preposterous. Presidents have always attended one another's library openings as a sign of respect. But I don't know, he answers. He probably wouldn't invite me. Trump mulls it over for a moment and says, as though he had never thought of the far-reaching ramifications of his ostracism from the club, why should he? It is an astonishing reminder of just how much has changed. On the subject of the location of his own presidential library, he uses our interview to distinguish himself from his predecessors and to take a swipe at them. That's a very interesting question. I have thought about it very little. I'm more thinking about all of the things that we're doing, which are a lot, he says, jutting his chin out proudly. I was left a lot. I was left a lot of problems that could have been solved a long time ago. I'm much more focused on that. He pauses. I have given it a little thought, and New York seems to be the most natural place, but Florida is another one. I know location, I guess, like nobody, says the former real estate developer. We'll pick somewhere very appropriate. He knows he will never be accepted into the club, and he wants to make it clear that he doesn't mind. When our interview comes to an end, and I'm on my way out, he shouts in a voice laden with sarcasm, "Say hi to President Bush for me." Next illustration, former Presidents Obama and the elder Bush standing shoulder to shoulder, doing a fist bump. The Outsider. A year earlier, when I met with Jimmy and Rosalind Carter at their home in Plains, Georgia, in the spring of 2018, Carter was still harboring hopes of being dispatched by Trump to negotiate a nuclear deal with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It always seemed far-fetched. In 2013, taking a dig at Obama, Trump wrote, "Former President Jimmy Carter is so happy that he is no longer considered the worst president in the history of the United States." In The Art of the Deal, Trump wrote that Carter had come to his office to ask for a $5 million donation to his presidential library. He was surprised that Carter had the nerve, the guts, to ask for something so extraordinary. Needless to say, Trump did not give it to him. He bragged about it, Carter said. That was one of his major selling points. I turned down Jimmy Carter. But Carter was one of the first people to call Trump to congratulate him on his election victory in 2016, a gesture Trump clearly appreciated, and friends say he is reluctant to attack Trump, in part because the Carter Center needs to work with the State Department. In 2016, the Carters voted for Bernie Sanders and not Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary, and they do not feel much warmth toward the Obamas. They were clearly disappointed that the Obamas had not sought their advice on leading effective post-presidential lives, and Carter felt that Obama did not pay him the proper respect when he was president. When Carter called Obama to offer advice or to brief him on a foreign trip, he would often get a call back from Tom Donilon, the president's national security advisor, who had been an intern in the Carter White House. For a former president, that was the ultimate humiliation. Trump is sympathetic to the way Carter has been treated by the other former presidents, which is why Carter is the only former president he has sought advice from while in office. One quiet Saturday night in April 2019, as the former president was about to serve himself at the buffet table at a friend's house, a call came from a White House operator announcing that Trump wanted to talk to him about China and trade. Carter set his plate down at the buffet table and picked up the phone. Trump spoke for most of the call, but Carter was able to ask about the status of talks with North Korea, and he advised the president to be flexible with the North Korean leader. Carter got in a dig about Trump's national security advisor at the time, John Bolton, a staunch reporter, a staunch supporter of the war in Iraq, to which Trump replied, "I call the shots." According to a person in the room, the 10-minute call left Carter unmoved, and after they hung up, he went back to the table, piled with platters of food, and quietly filled his plate as though nothing had happened. Later, when it was clear that Trump would not be sending him to broker any deal with the North Koreans or anyone else, Carter didn't pull any punches. "I think he's a disaster," he said unequivocally. At a Carter Center event in June 2019, he went further, saying that a full investigation would show that Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He was put into office because the Russians interfered. Any chance of the two developing a relationship was over. When Trump was asked to respond to Carter's assessment of him a day later, Trump replied witheringly, "He's a nice man. He was a terrible president. He's been trashed within his own party. He's been trashed." The patriarch. Trump was always well aware of how the Bush dynasty viewed him. He was not part of the plan. Jeb Bush was supposed to win the Republican nomination, and Trump got in the way. But George H.W. Bush's dislike of Trump ran deeper than Trump assumes. Bush was particularly disturbed when Trump, who received 4 student deferments from military service between 1964 and 1968, and 1 medical deferment after college, after a diagnosis of bone spurs in his heels, famously attacked John McCain at a Christian conservative gathering in the summer of 2015. "I like people who weren't captured," Trump said, referring to the Arizona senator's 5.5 years as a prisoner who was tortured at the infamous Hanoi Hilton when he was a Navy aviator during the Vietnam War. "He's not a war hero. He was a war hero because he was captured," Trump said at the event in Iowa during the Republican primary. "I can't understand how somebody could say that and still be taken seriously," Bush said, particularly upset because of his own service during World War II. This was a painful time for Bush, who did not recognize his own Republican Party. "I'm getting old," he told friends, "at just the right time." The erstwhile friend. The election of 2016 was the most rancorous in modern history, but before things devolved, Trump had a mutually advantageous relationship with the Clintons. He got affirmation from the presence of the former president and sitting U.S. senator at his 2005 wedding to Melania, where Hillary Clinton sat in the front row during the ceremony. "I had a very good relationship with both Clintons, actually. They came to my wedding to the First Lady. They were there," he told me, which, of course, I knew because I'd seen the much-discussed surreal photograph that showed the Clintons and the newly married Trumps beaming. The Clintons, in turn, got money. Trump made a $100,000 donation to the Clinton Foundation and other donations to Hillary's Senate campaigns before the two embarked on their jaw-dropping, no-holds-barred political feud. Bill Clinton may have been the reason Trump ran in the first place. He called Trump in late May 2015, a month after his wife announced her candidacy, and reportedly told him that he thought his message was resonating with frustrated conservatives who felt overlooked by the Republican establishment. He was intrigued when Trump confided in him that he was considering running for president. Clinton told Trump that he was tapping into a big part of the Republican electorate that was tired of career politicians. "It's a complicated story," Trump told me when I asked him directly whether Clinton encouraged him to run for president. Trump announced his candidacy weeks later. Clinton was a member of Trump National Golf Club in Briarcliff Manor, New York, 6 miles from the home the Clintons bought in Chappaqua after leaving the White House. Trump told New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd that he renovated the club in 1999 specifically to entice Clinton to join. It worked. "I'm proud to have him," Trump said when Clinton joined in May 2003. "He's a great gentleman, a good golfer, and a wonderful guy." Hillary even played golf there with her husband as part of his 65th birthday present. Remarkably, Bill Clinton still had a locker at the club during the heat of the campaign in the summer of 2016. New York-based radio host Boomer Esiason tweeted a photo of Clinton's locker that summer and wrote, "Next to my locker at Trump National, only in New York." When I asked Trump if he could see himself becoming friendly with a former president after leaving office or rekindling a friendship with Bill Clinton as one-time rivals and former presidents John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had done, he said, "It's possible. Anything's possible." The target, a president unraveling his predecessor's policies, is nothing new. But Trump does everything with unprecedented grandiosity. When he moved the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, he tweeted, "I fulfilled my campaign promise. Others didn't." At a closed-door event with Republican donors in March 2018, Trump called the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq the single worst decision ever made. He said George W. Bush's decision threw a big fat brick into a hornet's nest. He continued, "Here we are like the dummies of the world because we had bad politicians running our country for a long time." Trump's attacks on Bush 43 have cut far deeper than anything Obama said during the heat of the 2008 campaign, and there are rare moments when Bush has let his frustration show. Bob Scanlon, who was a White House florist when Bush was in office, recalled being invited to a 2016 lunch at the Bush's Florida vacation home shortly after Trump won the election. When Trump's name came up, Bush abruptly ended the conversation and said, "Can we stop talking about him and enjoy our lunch?" Even Bush's brother Neil told me he has not heard him talk much about Trump. But one former Trump official who is friends with Bush had a very different interaction with him. When he told Bush that he did not want to say anything in public that was critical of Trump, Bush replied, "Why not?" "Well, out of loyalty," the official said. "Oh yeah," Bush said sarcastically, "because he's been so loyal to you." According to a Trump aide, George W. Bush and the president have a relationship that has progressed a lot, in part because of Trump's nomination of Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. But one former senior Bush aide, who is in touch with Bush regularly, disputes that telling. "Trump doesn't reach out for advice often, but President Bush's door is always open. Kavanaugh thawed some of the ice, but the ice is coming from one side. Any inference that the two are close is far-fetched, according to another close current aide to Bush. The ignored mentor. The tradition of the departing president's leaving a note for his successor is relatively new. Reagan started the custom, and, as one would expect, his note had an ebullient touch, in part because the man who followed him into the White House was his trusted vice president, George H.W. Bush, but also because anything less than affable was not in Reagan's nature. "Don't let the turkeys get you down," was the note's heading. Reagan left the note on stationery with a Sandra Boynton cartoon depicting a crowd of turkeys trying to pull down an elephant, the symbol of the Republican Party. Reagan wrote it the morning he left office and stuck it in the top drawer of the Resolute desk. It was the beginning of a wonderful tradition. Bush's 1993 letter to Clinton was similarly lighthearted and encouraging. "I wish you great happiness here. I never felt the loneliness some presidents have described. There will be very tough times, made even more difficult by criticism you may not think is fair. I'm not a very good one to give advice, but just don't let the critics discourage you or push you off course. Your success is our country's success. I am rooting hard for you." Obama's note to Trump was decidedly less cheerful. In fact, he warned Trump to sustain the international order. He asked Trump to be kind, a request found in no other letters between presidents. "We've both been blessed in different ways with great good fortune," Obama wrote. "Not everyone is so lucky. It's up to us to do everything we can to build more ladders of success for every child and family that's willing to work hard." He ended the letter by wishing Trump and his wife Melania good luck and offering to help in any ways which we can. Trump called to thank Obama for the note right after reading it on the day of his inauguration, but Obama was traveling to Palm Springs for a vacation with his wife and missed the call. By the time Obama had one of his aides call Trump back, it was several days later, and the new president had signed an executive order banning entry to citizens from 7 mostly Muslim countries for 90 days. The Trump staffer told the Obama aide trying to arrange the call, "President Trump just wanted to thank Obama for the letter. No need to disturb them now." The time for any hint of camaraderie between the two men had clearly passed. And then there were 4. George H.W. Bush's passing marked the loss of the patriarch of the ex-presidents. He was most loyal to the standards of the club, including graciousness and self-restraint. He did not think that a former president should publicly criticize his successor, believing that it would do lasting damage to the presidency if every sitting president had to be looking over his shoulder. The last former president to see Bush before he died on November 30, 2018, was not George W. Bush, but a man who had little in common with him on paper aside from a shared job title. 3 days before he died, Bush, 94, welcomed Obama, the newest member of the President's Club, into his Houston home. That day, November 27th, Obama saw the man he called "My Buddy 41" for the last time. Bush had been in and out of hospitals and was still mourning the death of his beloved wife of 73 years, Barbara, less than 8 months before. He had good days and bad days now, but Obama was someone he wanted to see, even on a particularly bad day. Obama was still less than 2 years out of office. He was, in many ways, the polar opposite of Bush, the patrician head of a sprawling family with roots in New England and Texas and a decorated World War II Navy pilot. Bush already had a resume a mile long before he became president. Obama was born in Hawaii. His white mother was from Kansas, and his black father was from Kenya, and he served less than one term in the U.S. Senate before becoming the country's first African-American president. The two men were separated by generations and political parties, but they developed a genuine friendship, albeit one much less talked about than the father and son-like bond between Bush and Clinton. Obama admired Bush, who was among the last of the greatest generation. "Obama's a gentleman," Neil Bush told me, recalling Obama's call to check on his father during one stay in the ICU. "He looked up enough to my dad to show empathy and concern when Dad was suffering." Three photos on the wall of Neil Bush's office are of Obama. Dad worked hard to acknowledge the call, even though he couldn't really talk. Next illustration shows Carter waiting by the phone. As with any meeting between two former presidents, with the obvious exception of Bush 41 and Bush 43, who saw each other often, this one had been in the works for months. Bush's chief of staff, Jean Becker, was in touch with Obama's chief of staff, Anita Decker Breckinridge, to make a plan. Obama was going to be in Bush's hometown of Houston as the keynote speaker at the 25th anniversary celebration of the Baker Institute, named after Bush's Secretary of State and best friend, James Baker III. Bush told Becker that he would not be able to attend the event because of his health, although he told her he really wanted to see Obama. "I hope he stops by," he said. In October, when Bush returned from his annual summer stay at the family compound in Kennebunkport, Maine, Becker and Breckinridge began coordinating in earnest. While they are healthy, former presidents keep daunting schedules crammed with speeches, events, and looming book deadlines. The chiefs of staff to the former presidents speak regularly, sometimes with morbid questions, as was the case that previous winter, when Clinton's chief of staff gave Becker a call to get funeral planning advice. The meeting between Bush and Obama was one that neither former presidents wanted to miss. Knowing that it might be their last opportunity to see each other, Becker, who had been Bush's chief of staff since 1994 and was practically a member of the family, told me that she had a nagging feeling she could not shake. "I've never said this to anyone, but I remember quietly thinking to myself, I'm not sure President Bush will be here." When Obama arrived that November at the Bush's home in Houston's upscale Tanglewood community, Bush was having one of his bad days. He had Parkinson's disease and used a wheelchair or a motorized scooter, and he was not feeling well. His wife's death had shaken him. She had always said she hoped she would pass away before he did, because she could not imagine living without him. Now he was forced to live without her, and it was taking a heavy toll. The day after Barbara Bush's funeral, he was hospitalized because of an infection that spread to his blood. When asked if he really was up for a visit from Obama, Bush could not be swayed. He replied, "No, no, I feel good." As Becker ushered Obama into Bush's living room, she whispered to him, "If it were anybody else but you, we would have canceled this visit." Neil Bush and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham joined the two former presidents. George H.W. Bush was sitting in his wheelchair in the middle of the three men, smiling ear to ear as he sat quietly listening to the discussion, even though he was not able to participate in it much himself. Neil, who is the Bush's fourth child, told me that Obama specifically told Bush how much he admired his handling of foreign policy. After about 40 minutes, Obama asked if he could spend just 5 minutes alone with Bush. Everyone left the room to give them privacy for what would be their last moments together. When Obama was president, Bush returned to the White House several times, including two visits to the Oval Office and the unveiling of the official White House portraits of his son and daughter-in-law in May 2012. Obama's young staffers were in awe of Bush, who represented a different era in American politics, which, to be sure, was not always kind, but was not as relentlessly partisan as the politics of today. Before he needed a wheelchair, Bush walked up and down the hallways of the West Wing that he knew so well and teased Obama's aides, many of whom were in their 20s and 30s and were little kids when he was president. "Have you ever gone skydiving? Well, what are you waiting for?" He exuded graciousness and old-world manners, and because of his large, close family, he seemed to convey the message that politics is something that is a part of one's life, but should not define one's life. His kindness extended to private interactions with staff. Before Bush visited the White House for a July 2013 event honoring the winner of the 5,000th Daily Point of Light Award, part of the nonprofit encouraging volunteerism that Bush created and continued long after he left office, he called the Obama's social secretary, Deesha Dyer, to thank her and her staff for their work in preparing for his visit. During their call, he told her how excited he was that he would be seeing members of the resident staff who had taken care of his family when they lived in the White House. It was quintessential Bush. A note from the staff. Trump has disparaged all the former living presidents and has not said much about the dead ones. The only president he seems to truly admire is the 19th-century populist Andrew Jackson. He has a portrait of the slave-owning general who fought Native Americans hanging prominently in the Oval Office. Unlike most presidents, who are too busy with policy to make decorating decisions, Trump picked out his wallpaper and rugs. He enjoyed moving Winston Churchill's bust back to the Oval after Obama had it placed in a hallway outside the Treaty Room on the second floor of the residence. Everything Obama had done, from letting the rug in the West Wing corridors get dingy to moving that bust, was anathema to Trump. He enjoys giving tours of the White House. During the walkthroughs, he reportedly points to where Clinton conducted an affair with Monica Lewinsky and shows guests the private dining room off the Oval Office, which he says was badly cared for and even had a hole in the wall when he moved in. He tells them Obama would spend much of the day watching basketball there. Obama's aides say there was no hole in the wall, and Obama obviously did not spend his days watching basketball. Trump has since gotten a larger flat screen to replace the one Obama used. A senior diplomat who has met with Trump several times said he has a reptilian brain and judges a person almost entirely by his or her appearance. Straight out of central casting, he often says of his aides and of Vice President Mike Pence, who, according to Trump, looks just how a vice president should look. Cabinet members privately lament Trump's refusal to embrace an endearing trait in any politician, a willingness to be self-deprecating. Like the former presidents, who are often frustratingly restrained in their public views of Trump, the 100 maids, butlers, chefs, and florists who make the White House run every day try to stick to a strict code of not criticizing the sitting president. Their jobs depend on it. Presidents and first ladies expect the staff to stay quiet, and they also sympathize with the enormous pressure that all presidents face. They see members of the first family as three-dimensional people in a way that few get to witness. Trump mostly treats the resident staff well, according to several recently retired staffers, even offering to slip them hundreds of dollars in cash as tips for jobs well done, only to be told every time that they cannot accept tips because they are residents' employees. Brian Rock, the head engineer of the White House from 1988 to 2017, and Joel Jensen, who purchased food for the family during a White House tenure of more than 30 years, between 1986 and 2018, described the Trumps as easy to work for. Rock said that when 11-year-old Barron Trump, like any boy his age, wanted to see how things worked behind the scenes and got a tour of the White House chill room, where the air conditioners that cool the enormous house during blisteringly hot Washington summers are kept. Ginny Botero was the head of the housekeeping department at the White House from 2007 until 2018. Instead of the chaos that many decry, what with the early morning Twitter storms and Trump's alleged rampant infidelity, she said there was relative domestic tranquility in the private living quarters on the second and third floors. It was interesting to see how his grandchildren interacted with him. They adore him, Botero told me. I'd see them sitting on his lap in the family dining room on the second floor. He was very gracious and very genuine when I worked there. There was this disconnect. I'd ask myself, what's wrong? Why is he saying that on Twitter? That's not who he is behind closed doors. I think he wants people to think he's a tough guy. It is a WWE match on the world stage, with the president playing a role he cannot and will not step away from. Trump's bluster is an act, according to resident staffers. No one expected Trump to win, Botero said, adding that the president can be surprisingly kind. Sometimes I'd walk up to the fence on Pennsylvania Avenue after going out for lunch, and I'd look at the protesters and think, oh boy, do they have that all wrong. But there are differences between the private world of this White House and the way things were when the Obamas, the Bushes, and the Clintons lived there. Rock said he had a strange experience the night of Trump's inauguration. Rock was in charge of the room temperature in the residence. On inauguration night 2017, he was getting calls from the chief usher saying that the president was hot. 2 minutes later, he would get a call saying that the first lady was cold. I asked him, who are we catering to here? Because 99.9% of the time, we cater to the first lady. Only then did we realize they sleep in separate bedrooms. One recently retired staffer told me that she is in a book club where only 3 of the 20 members know that she worked in the Trump White House. If she told them, there would be too many questions, she said. Whenever anyone asks her where she worked, she tells them that she worked for the federal government. If they want more details, she tells them that she worked for the Department of Defense. People never know how to follow up on that, she said, laughing. But one longtime current residence staffer, who does not always agree with Trump's policies, lamented to me privately, there are days when I think, why am I making this person's life easier? It makes my blood boil. During our interview, when I ask Trump for his own take on reports of turbulence, he tells me that things are not always what they seem. You walked through. We have a very calm White House, he says, shaking his head and waving his arms toward the office where his staff sits, called the Outer Oval. A month ago, I was with 6 or 7 executives, and we were in a room where there was a television, and it was very calm, and we were negotiating some important thing for the country. It was on the news. Donald Trump is up in his residence, walking back and forth, screaming. They actually said, that's terrible, you're here. And it was so calm. It's fake news. It's all fake news. It's really terrible, he says. We have a very calm and very good White House. Desert Storm, Feuding Royals, A Deadly Planet. Before Star Wars or Game of Thrones, there was Dune, inside the new movie based on the legendary novel by Anthony Bresnahan. Opening photo, Heat Wave, Timothée Chalamet and Rebecca Ferguson in Jordan. Filming in the landscape was really surreal, says Chalamet. And Galaxy Quest, Zendaya, The House Atreides. Denis Villeneuve directs Javier Bardem. Timothée Chalamet remembers the darkness. It was the summer of 2019, and the cast and crew of Dune had ventured deep into the sandstone and granite canyons of southern Jordan, leaving in the middle of the night so they could catch the dawn on camera. The light spilling over the chasms gave the landscape an otherworldly feel. It was what they had come for. "It was really surreal," says Chalmé. "There are these Goliath landscapes, which you may imagine existing on planets in our universe, but not on Earth. They weren't on Earth anymore anyway. They were on a deadly, dust-dry battleground planet called Arrakis." In Frank Herbert's epic 1965 sci-fi novel, Arrakis is the only known location of the galaxy's most vital resource, the mind-altering time and space-warping spice. In the new film adaptation, directed by Arrival and Blade Runner 2049 filmmaker Denis Villeneuve, Chalmé stars as the young royal Paul Atreides, the proverbial stranger in a very strange land, who's fighting to protect this hostile new home, even as it threatens to destroy him. Humans are the aliens on Arrakis. The dominant species on that world are immense, voracious sandworms that burrow through the barren drifts like subterranean dragons. For the infinite seas of sand that give the story its title, the production moved to remote regions outside Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, where the temperatures rivaled the fiction in Herbert's story. "I remember going out of my room at 2 a.m., and it being probably 100 degrees," says Chalmé. During the shoot, he and the other actors were costumed in what the world of Dune calls stillsuits, thick, rubbery armor that preserves the body's moisture, even gathering tiny bits from the breath exhaled through the nose. In the story, the suits are life-giving. In real life, they were agony. "The shooting temperature was sometimes 120 degrees, says Chalmé. "They put a cap on it out there if it gets too hot. I forget what the exact number is, but you can't keep working." The circumstances fed the story they were there to tell. In a really grounded way, it was helpful to be in the still suits and to be at that level of exhaustion. It wouldn't be Dune if it were easy. Herbert's novel became a sci-fi touchstone in the 1960s, heralded for its world-building and ecological subtext, as well as its intricate, some say impenetrable, plot, focusing on two families struggling for supremacy over Arrakis. The book created ripples that many see in everything from Star Wars to Alien to Game of Thrones. Still, for decades, the novel itself has defied adaptation. In the 70s, the Wild Man experimental filmmaker Alejandro Jodorowsky mounted a quest to film it, but Hollywood considered the project too risky. David Lynch brought Dune to the big screen in a 1984 feature, but it was derided as an incomprehensible mess and a blight on his filmography. In 2000, a Dune miniseries on what's now the Sci-Fi Channel became a hit for the cable network, but it is now only dimly remembered. Villeneuve intends to create a Dune that has so far only existed in the imagination of readers. The key, he says, was to break the sprawling narrative in half. When Dune hits theaters on December 18th, it will only be half the novel, with Warner Brothers agreeing to tell the story in two films, similar to the studio's approach with Stephen King's It and It Chapter 2. "I would not agree to make this adaptation of the book with one single movie," says Villeneuve. "The world is too complex. It's a world that takes its power in details." For Villeneuve, this 55-year-old story about a planet being mined to death was not merely a space adventure, but a prophecy. "No matter what you believe, Earth is changing, and we will have to adapt," he says. "That's why I think that Dune This book was written in the 20th century. It was a distant portrait of the reality of the oil and the capitalism and the exploitation, the over-exploitation of Earth. Today, things are just worse. It's a coming-of-age story, but also a call for action for the youth. Chalamet's character, Paul, thinks he's just a boy struggling to find a place in the world, but he actually possesses the ability to change it. He has a supernatural gift to harness and unleash energy, lead others, and meld with the heart of his new home world. Think Greta Thunberg, only she's a Jedi with a degree from Hogwarts. Paul comes from a powerful galactic family with a name that sounds like a constellation, the House of Atreides. His father and mother, Duke Leto, played by Oscar Isaac, and Lady Jessica, Rebecca Ferguson, take their son from their lush, Scandinavian-like home world to preside over spice extraction on Arrakis. What follows is a clash with the criminal, politically connected house, Harkonnen. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.